And now, News Talk 1360 WCHL presents Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show about getting educated, getting hired, and getting inspired. Hosted by the staggeringly positive Kristen Heemstra, an experienced human resources manager and college admissions consultant. And now, here's Kristen on WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra with the Art of Potential show, and I am so excited because we have the best show in store for you. My guest today is Dr. Deborah Tannen. Welcome, Dr. Tannen.
Such a pleasure to be here.
So in case you're unfamiliar with her and you may have been under a rock for a little while, let me tell you what she is known for, which is sociolinguistics. Probably the thing that most people are familiar with is a book called You Just Don't Understand, and it's about men and women in conversation. It's been 4 years, including 8 months, as a number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. And then, of course, you also have several other bestsellers, including You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, and your most recent book is about sisters, You Were Always Mom's Favorite. So excited to have you here. Must ask you, what drew you to sociolinguistics, as well as what is that exactly?
It would be the study of language as it's used in social relationships. Linguistics is the field that studies language, and mm-hmm. a lot of it is fairly technical, but the sociolinguistic side is how people are using language in their everyday lives. I actually came to it late in life. I had lived in Greece for a number of years. Then I had gotten a master's in English, and I was teaching writing. And toward the end of my 20s, I just was getting bored, and I wanted to do something a little bit more technical, get back into the classroom. I was just very lucky that I went to a linguistics conference that focused on sociolinguistics. And I was just immediately sucked in. I thought, this is it. I'm going to use my love of language, my love of my interest in people and their relationships, put them together, and you've got sociolinguistics.
So this was a second career for you then?
Yeah. I think you could say that.
Oh, that is fascinating. So when you lived in Greece, did you learn to speak Greek then?
I did.
Okay.
And I And in the beginning, it was just I taught English just as a way to support myself so that I could stay there. But I always loved language, and I did immediately start learning Greek. And along the way, I wrote a book about a modern Greek writer and her life and work. So that got me that got my Greek even better. I had to do all the reading about her and about Greek literature and Greek.
And that would be interesting to pick up nuances in a language that's not native to you, I'm sure.
And it also was the beginning of my interest in cross-cultural differences, just seeing how people used language differently. Once you had translated the words, you still didn't necessarily know how to use those words.
Right.
Some of my, and the first book that I wrote for general audiences was not You Just Didn't Understand, the one about women and men. It was called That's Not What I Meant. And it's all these sociolinguistic patterns that can differ from one culture to another. And it could be differences among people from different parts of the United States or different cultures. But an example that I encountered so early on among Greeks, very often indirectness was the norm.
Okay.
So if a spouse asked, would you like to go to a party? And there would be an assumption, if you asked, you probably want to go.
Right.
And so the answer might be, okay. And then if you say, you sure you want to go? Well, they must really not want to go, or they wouldn't bring it up again. And I was often falling into those patterns with talking to people from Greece where I was not picking up hints that they thought were self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
They were picking up hints that I thought I had not sent.
And that must have made for some uncomfortable moments when you're trying to negotiate that space between you and the people that,
I'll give you an example that a woman told me when she was growing up. This was an older Greek woman. She said if she asked her father if she could go to a party and he said, if you want, you can go, that meant she shouldn't go. If he really wanted her to go, he might say, great idea, you should go. And then you can imagine an American, Greek-American cousin visiting, asking her uncle, he says, if you want, you could go. And she goes, and he thinks, what's with these American kids? They have no respect. thinking, he's hypocritical. He said I could go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I can imagine. I mean, that example alone, I work a lot with teenagers, and it's hard enough when you come from the same background and, you know, you have the same parents that have raised you your whole life. But yet to try to do the cross-cultural thing, a lot of the folks around our area are from different cultures, and the kids trying to navigate the space in the schools and then back home, and the parents trying to understand the languages we use in the schools, it's caused a lot of challenges.
Yeah, you're so right. And just that question of indirectness ends up being one of the major patterns that I ended up finding between women and men. So classic conversation. This was actually in my first book. That's not what I meant, but I repeated it.
Yeah.
And you just didn't understand, and it ended up being what I think of as one of the greatest hits from that book, a conversation where a husband and wife are riding in the car, and she turns to him and says, are you thirsty, dear? Would you like to stop for a drink? And he isn't, so he says no. And then later it turns out she's annoyed because she had wanted to stop, and he's annoyed because he says something like, you know, well, why didn't you tell me? Why do you play games with me? You want me to be a mind reader? And my analysis is that when she asked, would you like to stop for a drink, she probably was not expecting a yes-no answer. She probably expected something like, well, I don't know, how do you feel about it? And then she could say, well, I don't know, how do you feel about it? And the idea is that when she asked, would you like to stop for a drink, she was showing that she was interested in his preference. She wasn't just going to make a demand. And she heard the answer no as, I'm not interested in your preferences. I am going to make a demand. And it's just different... different senses of how a conversation should go, different conversational ritual is a term I sometimes use. So for some people, you start by asking everybody their preferences, and then you make a decision taking it into account. It might be, yeah, we'll go because if you want to, or it might be, I'm tired, do you mind if we don't? Or it might be, we could, but let's make it brief. It could be anything,
right.
But you showed that you care.
Yeah.
On the other hand, for other people, well, you make a decision, and anyone who isn't happy with it can question it. If she didn't like my answer, no, she'll tell me.
And the assumption is she will tell me, and everything will be fine because I'll listen if she'll tell me.
Yeah, and I saw quite parallel patterns in the workplace. Because after You Just Didn't Understand, the book I wrote next was Talking from 9 to 5 about the workplace. And I remember a manager saying to me, I make a decision, I announce it, and I assume that if anyone isn't happy with it, they'll tell me. Well, that will work for some people, but not others.
Right, and other people will take quite an affront that you would do that without getting our input into the decision-making process.
Exactly. So it's really quite parallel to the wife who hears no, and that's it. The decision's made, non-negotiable. And then... so when he says, why didn't you tell me? She might say, well, we always do what you want. You don't care what I want.
Then you've opened up a whole can of worms you never even meant to get near in the first place.
Exactly. And the same thing can happen in the workplace with, you're right. On the one hand, somebody feeling he's not taking our preferences into account. And the other one feeling nobody said anything, so I'm sure we're all fine.
So let me ask you this. The example from the workplace, is that typically also male-female? So the male will announce, this is my decision, assuming that the females will then come forward if they don't agree with it? Or are both genders kind of in that category?
That is not one that I looked at across genders, so I wouldn't be able to say for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I would guess it might be somewhat more common for it to be a male manager to make those assumptions. Certainly not all male managers would. Right. And I think this is a good point at which to point out nothing is true of all women and men.
Yeah.
The fact that I started out really looking at cross-cultural differences has made me very aware of that. But that doesn't mean that there aren't tendencies that might pattern by gender. So, yeah, for example, there was a woman manager who I got to know very well. I shadowed her. She taped her conversations. There were a number of companies where I did that with a number of people. right, she was one. And at one point, there was an upward evaluation, and she was told, you don't listen to us. And she was surprised, and I was surprised, because I saw that she always started by asking everybody for their input. Well, it turned out, when she asked for this man's input, he thought she was asking him to decide.
Oh.
So he thought, well, you asked me what to do, I told you what to do, and you didn't listen to me. And I think that can happen at home as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, that does often pattern by gender, where a woman might be asking for a man's input, and he thinks he's being asked to decide.
And then he has to own it. Okay, I want to talk more about this. We do need to take a quick break. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to the Art of Potential show, and I am talking with sociolinguistic Dr. Deborah Tannen. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to the Art of Potential show, and my guest is Dr. Deborah Tannen, and we are talking about the communication differences between males and females, among other things. So one question that struck me from the last comments you were making, men and women, they have different cultures, would you say?
I think metaphorically we can look at it that way.
Okay.
Yes.
So in terms of how children are kind of normed as they're being raised, like are younger children going to have different, girls going to have different communication patterns than boys as they're growing up?
Yes. When I talk about this and as I wrote about it, and you just didn't understand, I pretty much traced all the patterns that I described to the way girls and boys learn to use language growing up. So people that have studied kids at play have noticed that they do tend to play with other kids of the same sex if they have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, with siblings and people in the neighborhood or family members, it might not always have a choice.
Right.
But when they do, they tend to prefer other children of the same sex. And the patterns are something like this. So typically, a little girl will have a best friend, and they spend a lot of time sitting and talking. And often it's secrets. So who you tell your secrets to determines who your best friend is. I collect pictures from all over the world, and I have found them from all over the world, of two little girls, and one is whispering in the other.
Oh, wow.
I've never encountered a similar picture of a boy. They tend to talk a lot about who's close to whom, you know, who's best friends, your second best friend, your third best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. And girls are clicky because only your friends can know your secrets. So you really can't have girls around that you don't want to be friends with. The boys tend to
be a threat. Yeah.
So boys tend to play in larger groups. It's often the activity that's central. So boys, it's an interesting contrast because girls really don't like girls who tell them what to do. You don't really hear girls giving direct orders, do this, do that. You hear it a lot among the boys, and that's the way they're negotiating who's up and who's down, where the girls are negotiating who's in and who's out. And so for the girls, maybe...
It's almost harsher. Like, if you're down, at least you're still in.
Yes, you know, that's exactly correct. So as somebody once said, you need a certain number of boys for the team. So, if there are boys that are not liked, they aren't shut out the way girls will be. They may be pushed around and mistreated. So we develop different sensitivities. I don't think it's the case that women are more sensitive, but we are sensitive to different things. So often, boys and men will be very sensitive to being put down or pushed around, where girls and women will be sensitive to being pushed away or left out.
Yeah.
And that, it's amazing how those patterns really turned up in so many of the research projects that I undertook. For example, families and sisters versus brothers. It was stunning to me how frequently family members who were hurt by something their family did. For girls and women, it was about not being told something or not being invited to something, not being included in something. Whereas for the boys and the men, it was often feeling you'd been put down or told what to do. by somebody in the family.
That is utterly fascinating. And I'm just, what was going through my mind as you were saying that is I see so many women bossing around men, and they must really hate that.
Well, you know, sometimes very early on, I was intrigued. Why do we have this stereotype of women being nags?
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that women are telling men what to do more than men are telling women what to do? It didn't seem really likely that that was the case. And I think sometimes it's these different assumptions. So I think many women often feel if we love each other, we're going to want to do what the other one wants. So I just have to let you know what I want, and you're going to want to do it.
Oh.
And now, if he perceives that as you're telling me what to do, he might want to put it off so that he doesn't feel he's being told what to do. He feels he's doing it of his own volition. And then she starts to think, gee, I guess I didn't make it clear I really want him to do it, so I'll tell him again. And he thinks, gee, you know, I'm going to end up being henpecked if I don't watch it here. So,
yeah.
And it's a process that often happens where we react to each other by driving each other into more extreme forms of the opposing behavior.
Oh, interesting.
So women sometimes really will get a better response if they just bite your tongue and just wait longer than you think would make sense. And maybe
like years.
You will end up doing it.
And then at that point, there will be, you know, what you're saying, it won't be that you told me what to do. There's probably some type of intellectual barrier that's crossed of, well, she told me this, but really now I'm choosing to do it because I made it clear I wasn't going to do it when she asked. So now it's my choice.
I know. It's so frustrating to think about it that way. You think, oh, let's all just get over it.
Right.
But we do react that way. And I don't think we don't think it through. It's kind of, I guess, automatic reactions. And often women are reacting in an automatic sort of way to thinking that they're being ignored or pushed aside, where men might react the way we do to their saying, you're telling me what to do. I was walking along campus one day with a female colleague, and one of our male colleagues came by, and it was a crisp fall day, and he wasn't wearing a jacket. She said something, hi, where's your coat? And he said, thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
And she was puzzled because I was just being friendly, but it made sense if you think of it from the perspective of who's up, who's down. It's true that mothers ask their children to put on their coat or wear their galoshes. Mm-hmm. So I think both patterns often are there, but it's which ones we tend to react to, which ones kind of push our buttons.
Is some of that based on patterns we've seen with other couples? Like, I'm just trying to think as I'm applying this, and, you know, I'm sure it's a female thing to kind of pick out your own examples in your own life, but it strikes me that we repeat patterns that we've seen in our parents. And I don't know that you can speak to this, but these clearly are learned generationally, cross-culturally.
You know, I think we do pick up from not only parents, but all the people we see around us, and even what we see in movies and TV, as to what are expected reactions to things. So I think there is some of that. But kids seem really good at picking up how mothers talk, how fathers talk. If you ask them to play the other role, they can do it.
They can. And sometimes you don't really want to see them do that. Because they do. They can nail you sometimes with the way they...
That's right. I know it can be embarrassing how perceptive they are.
How much they notice. Well, okay, so let's talk about then how do men communicate that they want to be close to somebody? Is that any different than how women communicate how they want to be close to somebody?
Well, I think understandings of how we show being close tend to vary in a way that's parallel to what I described about kids.
Mm-hmm.
So very often, many men will feel we're close because we're doing things together.
So it's a proximity, activity-based.
Shared activity. Yeah, on the activity. We're doing things together. And don't feel that need for telling secrets that women often feel. So she may feel we're close because I can tell you everything. And he might feel we're close because we can do things together. And if I need you, you'll be there. It's very common, you know, if I ask a group of people, think of your best friend. How recently have you spoken to him or her? For most women, they will have spoken to their best friend possibly within the last day, probably within the last week, and absolutely within the last month.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to say, there's my best friend, but I haven't talked to her in 3 years.
Right.
That could be the case for men, but the feeling would be if I needed him, he'd be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I also think of I was once riding in the car with a taxi driver. We were talking about this kind of stuff. And he said, oh, my wife and I have good communication, but sometimes when she talks to me, I just don't answer. And I'm thinking, he doesn't think that's good communication, I would guess. So I asked why. He said, well, sometimes what she says just doesn't make any sense. They asked for an example. He said, well, I was watching the ball game, and I'm realizing now that's probably already a problem.
Right.
He probably feels, sit next to me, we'll watch the game together, we're together.
Right.
But she's probably thinking, we need to be talking.
Right.
So he said, I was watching the ball game, and she said to me, what should my brother do? And he said, her brother's 35. Why should I give him advice?
Right.
So this question, why would she tell me about a situation involving her brother? It taps into this fundamental assumption about what it means to be close, that for many women, we talk about people and their problems and what we're thinking and what they're thinking. And all of that together means we're close. And for him, while we're here together, doing something together, we're close. So why do you want to tell me about a problem? It must be you want me to solve it.
Right, because otherwise you wouldn't burden me with this.
Right.
Oh, wow. All right, we're going to take another break. And I just have to say it's amazing men and women get together at all. You are listening to the Art of Potential show. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Deborah Tannen.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to the Art of Potential show, and I am talking with Dr. Deborah Tannen. We are talking about male-female communication and just kind of communication in general. Now, we just were talking about a woman kind of, it sounds like she was asking her husband advice about her brother.
Well, I think what happened was she was just looking for a topic to talk about.
So it was a bonding experience she was trying to throw out.
Yes, and most of what we do is all about bonding in some way. And I think for guys, it's not that they're not looking to bond. They're just maybe doing it in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that talking about people and what's going on in their lives, especially problems in their lives, are prime topics for girls and women to talk about. And they're just not that common for boys and men to talk about. Again, not that they never would,
right,
but it may not be what they most frequently or most comfortably are inclined to do. So my guess is that in the situation I described, she was thinking, here we are together, we should be talking. I don't have any problems to mention, so maybe we can talk about somebody else's. How about my brother's?
She's going through a catalog in her mind.
It's one of the ways you kind of think about how we handle lives, how do we deal with things in our lives. And it's almost like a lot of it comes down to a showing of caring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you care about me? And so being willing to talk about this stuff is for many women, just you take it for granted as the way you show your interest in each other.
Which is very interesting because the intention behind what you're doing is to bond and is to connect and is to build greater intimacy in your relationship.
And then, and I think what's most challenging about there being differences is seems self-evident to us that this is the way you do it. So just realizing that there are cultural differences, and if it's between women and men, maybe metaphorically cultural differences, that the fact that you're not bonding in the way I would expect you to doesn't mean you don't want to bond with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, one of the really important insights.
Definitely. And it takes the judgment off of it, which is so important because you're, you know, not judging yourself or judging the other person if they're not responding to you in the way that you have set up in your mind that you think they should.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the most gratifying responses and most common responses that I get to, especially You Just Don't Understand about women and men, but in a way all the books have written. It's a relief to know I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relief to know there is not necessarily something wrong with me, something wrong with my partner, something wrong with our relationship, that I'm having these frustrations.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. In terms of the cultural piece, you know, men, women talk differently. What about, have you studied Northerners and Southerners at all?
Yes, as well as Northern, Southern versus Midwest versus New England. Let me give you what I think is a classic example of a Northern-Southern difference.
Okay.
I was talking to a friend who was from South Carolina about a third person, and I asked what she thought of him, and she said, I don't really know him. And I said, well, I think he's a jerk. And she said, that's what I just said. And I said, excuse me? And she said, well, in South Carolina, you can't say that somebody is a jerk. You just can't say it.
Right.
Now, you may have guessed I'm from New York City, where we can say that.
Right.
And it would be an exaggeration. We might not even think it. we talk in extremes, partly to be funny, I should point out. So she said, well, in South Carolina, you can't say somebody's a jerk. So you proceed on the assumption that if I got to know him, I would find something to like about him. So if you say I don't really know him, it means I haven't found anything to like about him. So I thought this was amusing, but I wasn't convinced. And not too long after, I met somebody else from South Carolina, a gentleman, and I said, let me try this out on you. If you ask somebody what they thought of someone, and that person said, I don't really know him, what does that mean? And he said, that means he's a no good, no count. So that was reinforcement of her interpretation. So that would be an example of North-South. The question of how direct you can be about saying something negative. People often point out that in the South, you can say negative things about people as long as you say bless their heart.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, there's that whole bless their heart.
After you say it. Also, how much small talk might be expected before you can get to the point of a conversation, which might be more in the South than in the North. Of course, we all know about differences in just words, you know, whether you call something soda or pop or a hoagie or a submarine, but I think these differences in how you say what you mean are probably the more tricky.
Well, absolutely they are, and that, you know, brings up a really interesting point, because I'm just trying to think with how, you know, we're doing all the Skyping now with job interviews, and you've got all these ways that people are communicating, and in thinking about the small talk question and how you communicate. If you're interviewing with a firm in New York City and you're from the South, and you're in the South, you bond by your small talk. You find areas of commonality. You know, you find similar places you've been or things that you've done. And this may drive someone from New York absolutely crazy.
Yes. There's always an awareness. It's always helpful to have an awareness of how what you're saying is coming across. So if you can develop antenna to pick up cues about how the person is reacting, then you can try to adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's even a matter of talking about it. I call it meta communicating. That's M-E-T-A, meta communicating. In other words, communicate about communicating. So you could, if you get the sense that the person's getting antsy, you might try doing something slightly differently, or say, perhaps in the South where what I'm doing right now would be normal in the South, and maybe it doesn't seem quite right here. Another difference, and this is one that can be North-South or Midwest, it would be a question of how long a pause is normal between turns. And we know that this can vary very slightly, even just milliseconds of pause, or several seconds of pause, depending on the part of the country that you're from. So in New York, for example, or other kind of parts of the Northeast, there might be a very short pause between turns before someone starts to think you have nothing to say and I'd better fill in the pause. I think in the South, it's a little bit longer. In the Midwest, it's much longer. In New England, it's much longer. So a person might be interrupted because they're waiting for that long pause that never comes
right.
in one conversation, and might become the interrupter in a conversation with someone else because the length of pause that they are looking for is shorter than that person is. So if you perceive that you're spending all your time talking and the other person is not, you might just need to count to seven after you think they have nothing to say. If you're the one who keeps getting interrupted, never getting the floor, you might try pushing yourself to start speaking before it really seems comfortable to do so. And in both cases, you may be stunned to find out that the other person, either on the one hand, does have plenty to say, or on the other, is quite happy to listen. Those are just small adjustments we can make that can change the way the other person is talking to us.
Which brings up a really interesting point, how what we do impacts how other people talk to us. Because I always feel like when people are searching to interrupt, it's more, and this is a personal thing, and I don't know if there's research on this or not, but it's more of a power play of what you're saying isn't important, and therefore I need to trump you by what I have to say.
Well, yes. I mean, what you're saying is a universal tendency to interpret it that way.
Right.
When we feel that we're being interrupted, we feel the person is doing a power play.
Mm-hmm.
You only want to hear yourself talk. You think you're more important. You think you're more knowledgeable. And sometimes that's the case. There are people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it really is just a matter of missed cues and different conversational habits. So the question about how long a pause you're expecting is one example of that, where if you talk to someone who's just waiting for a longer pause, they may never get the chance to talk and you end up interrupting, and that really was not your intention.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may be uses of overlap. There are some styles where the way you show you're listening is to kind of talk along. And sometimes that can be perceived as you're taking the floor. So the person who stops may be the one creating the interruption, not the one who started, because they started, but they didn't intend you to stop. They thought they were just going to talk along to encourage you.
Oh, wow.
So that would be another way where it could seem like the person wants to interrupt, but the effect may not be what they intended. And then there are all kinds of other things about, for example, do you wait to be asked or do you volunteer? So I have encountered couples where families have different styles. So one may say, your family is not interested in me. They never ask me anything. Whereas the family may be feeling, why is she or he so private? They never tell me anything.
They never
volunteer. In one case, you're waiting for people to volunteer, and in the other case, you're waiting to be asked. And that could lead to different and sometimes erroneous
assumptions about
whether people are interested in you or not.
Well, this is just fascinating. Dr. Tannen, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us on this topic. This is Kristen Heemstra, and you are listening to The Art of Potential Show.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and you are listening to the Art of Potential show. I am talking with Dr. Deborah Tannen, and this has just been a fascinating show on communication in general. So my question to you is, Dr. Tannen, do we just talk with our words? Do we talk with our bodies? Do we talk? What are the different ways we actually communicate?
We communicate with everything, bodies, facial expression, gaze, gestures, and even if we say talk, it's not just the words, it's tone of voice, how loudly or softly we speak, how we string ideas together. One of the first patterns that I observed that really made me think about conversations between women and men as a kind of cross-cultural communication was about nonverbal positioning of our bodies. So this goes back a while, and I had been invited by a psychologist. His name was Bruce Dorval, and he had been interested in how best friends talk to each other. So he had invited pairs of best friends into his office, and he videotaped them talking to each other at a range of ages, starting with five-year-olds going up to college students. And then he got a little grant from the Social Science Research Council, and he brought in experts in a number of fields. Only 12 of us was a small meeting to look at these tapes and bring our own disciplines to bear on them. I had intended at that time to be studying repetition, how people pick up each other's words and we weave others' words into our own talk. And I did end up writing quite a bit about that in my linguistic writing. But when I looked at these videotapes, I could not get over this pattern I was seeing that had nothing to do with talk or what anybody was saying. At every age, the little girls and the older girls and the women tended to face each other directly, in other words, orient their bodies in a face-to-face stance, and lean in as they talk to each other. And at every age, the boys and the men tended to sit and orient their bodies at angles or even parallel and look around the room. They did not look at each other directly, hardly at all. If one looked at the other would look away.
Oh, wow.
They glanced at each other sideways, but they didn't keep that direct face-to-face gaze looking at each other as they talked. And this was really one of the first things that got me thinking, my goodness, this is a gender pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Right around that time, I was talking to a psychologist friend of mine, and she said, you know, couples come to me in therapy, and it's the same thing. She said, the men don't look at their wives. The men don't look at me. The men are always disengaged.
So she was reading that as engagement.
Yes, and that really got my danger signal beeping, because it was pretty clear to me that many of the men, and most of them, in fact, they weren't disengaged. They were very engaged. But
mm-hmm.
So she was assuming that these people that came to her in therapy, that they must mean or feel what she would mean or feel if she spoke in that way or behaved in that way in that context, but that might not have been accurate for many of the men who came. So I think her conclusion they were disengaged was probably not accurate, at least not in all cases.
Right.
Not to say it might never have been the case, but it would not necessarily have been the case because they didn't keep that face-to-face gaze. So that's an example of how we're communicating. People so often ask me, wouldn't it be a better world if we all listened better?
That's a loaded question.
Yes, of course it would.
Right.
But I think it more often creates a problem that whether or not we show how we show we're listening. So I think women often get the impression men are not listening because they don't look at us the way a woman might look at us when she's listening. Or how much of these listening noises do we make? Research has shown, this is not my research, but others, that women tend to say, they tend to do more of it than men tend to use. And it seems, too, that women will often say, to mean I'm listening, whereas men might not be inclined to say, unless they agree. And so, again, it's how we show we're listening and what those listening noises mean. So I think that is one of the reasons that men sometimes think women are hypocritical and you can't trust us because we've been saying yes, 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 and then it turns out we don't agree.
When the whole time we're just trying to figure out the angle you're coming from.
Well, we're just showing we're listening.
Right. Just connecting. That is, and from a counseling perspective, which is where my background is, there's, what we call active listening, which is the traditional female. What you're explaining to me is kind of the female way of listening, where you sit, you almost literally point your heart at their heart. You want to make sure that you're focused on the person so they know that you are giving them your undivided attention and and you do the, you know, repeating back of what they're saying without putting any emphasis on whether you agree or not agree. There's just a whole line of active listening skills that almost sound counterintuitive to a way a male would like to be acknowledged in some ways in a situation like that.
Absolutely, yes. And I think you're right. It is like a hyper-female way of doing listening. And that doesn't mean that it might not work well for many men as well.
Yeah.
It might. It just has to do with what we're used to and what we expect and how we interpret the way other people are communicating with us in our everyday lives.
It does, and there's a point, I think, of feeling that you might be on show if somebody is paying that much attention to you. And it doesn't strike me as men, particularly if they're talking about an issue that's makes them vulnerable, which they don't want to do anyway, because, of course, no men are vulnerable. But it's, you know, one of those things of, I don't know that I want to be under that much scrutiny as I'm...
Absolutely. That's such a good way to put it. And it's because of those patterns that I noticed, which I just described in those videotapes, that it suddenly made sense. Many women who have sons or find with men in their lives, that if you sit them opposite you and say, ask them to talk, tell you something private, you might not get very much.
Right.
But if you talk while you're driving in the car, in which case it's not necessary to look directly at each other, you may get more. Or if you're doing something together, you might actually learn more. One woman told me she was always suggesting to her teenage son that he come for a ride in the car because she had learned that she was going to get a lot more information that way.
He would disclose information he normally. So that's a lesson to all teenage boys. Beware if your mother wants to take you for a car ride. Well, I would like to say thank you so much for joining us. This has just been such an enlightening conversation. And for the listeners who would like to know more about you and your research, where can they reach you?
My website is deborahtannen.com. That's Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H.
And I will also have a link to her website on my website, which is The Art of Potential, artofpotential.com. And if you have ideas for the show or would like to share your thoughts, we would love to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at Art of Potential or join our Facebook page. You have just listened to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra.
1360 WCHL wants to connect with you online for updates on our lifestyle programs, awesome giveaways, contests, trivia, community photos, breaking news, and more. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/Chapelboro and become our fan on Facebook, and always connect with us online at chapelboro.com.